You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to have brunch with Bernie today, but he's going to be here in our second hour. He's got a schedule conflict, so stick around. If you're calling for Bernie, wait an hour. We're going to do Anything Goes Friday. But first, I started sharing with you yesterday a little bit of Harry Truman, and got so much positive feedback on it over at TomHartman.com and in other venues. And it is so timely. It is like we are seeing an absolute repeat of the Congress of 1948, and that with these Republicans. And so I want to share a little more Harry Truman with you, and actually I want to even expand it. I want to put this in a context. One of the things that we used to know as Americans, and we knew this literally from the George Washington administration, Alexander Hamilton wrote about it in his report on manufacturers, if not explicitly, certainly implicitly, and it was used by virtually every administration from the George Washington administration until the Herbert Hoover administration, was the knowledge that there are cycles to capitalism, cycles to private business. It's referred to as the business cycle. There have been all these different, economists and pseudo-economists who've tried to come up with ways to predict the business cycle, the Kondracki wave and the Stinson wave and there's a whole bunch of them. And when the stock market does this, then that's going to happen. When this happens, that's going to, whatever. People try to figure out, but everybody understands that there are these cycles that of boom and bust in our economy have been from day one. We were in a downturn in 1773 when the British passed the Tea Act to try to help out the British East India Company. It was the government of England trying to help out the biggest corporation in the world because we were in a down part of the business cycle. And that's how government has always reacted, is when the business cycle is down, government steps in and increases spending and supports private businesses in a whole variety of ways. And when the business and individuals as well, there are automatic stabilizers, in fact, that do this. Unemployment insurance is one of them. Food stamps is another one. So, when the business cycle's down, government spending goes up. It's supposed to. And the flip side of that is when the business cycle is up, when business is making money and employment is full and the times are good, that's when it's appropriate for government to actually scale back its spending and increase taxation. Because you can take a little money out of the economy, and the economy is not going to, be hurt by that, increased taxes. And you can scale back government spending because the slack will be picked up by the private economy. And when the private economy starts falling apart again in the next business cycle, then government steps in and fills it. And the first president to not do this in a big way was Herbert Hoover. Stock market crash in 1929. Andrew Mellon was his secretary of the Treasury. Andrew Mellon, a major bankster. And Andrew Mellon said, liquidate everything. Liquidate labor. Liquidate stocks. Liquidate banks. Liquidate it all. And Herbert Hoover just let it all fall apart. And for 3 years, Herbert Hoover, the Republican president, and the Republican Congress just let it all fall apart. And every year saying, if government just gets out of the way, the private economy will put it all back together. And we went from full employment to 10% unemployment to 15 to 20 to 25 to 30 to 35% unemployment by the time Franklin Roosevelt came into office, or thereabouts. So anyhow, this was such conventional wisdom that Harry Truman just kind of refers to it in passing. All Americans knew this. This is what's amazing to me, is this amnesia, this great forgetting, that Americans today don't realize this. We're in the trough of a business cycle right now. We're in the down part of a business cycle. Government should be borrowing and spending more. Paul Krugman is saying it. There's a whole bunch of Nobel Prize winning economists out there who are saying it, but no Republican will get that. But anyhow, here's Harry. I just want to share with you Harry Truman. He's talking about taxes, but he just kind of, this is just a throwaway line. You know, during times of prosperity, this was after World War II. America was experiencing prosperity. And so he's like, you know, let's cut, you know, we can cut taxes on average working people, but, you know, we should be raising taxes on the rich. And that ain't exactly what the Republicans in the House of Representatives did. So Harry Truman talking about this.
Now, everybody likes to have low taxes. But we must reduce the national debt in times of prosperity.
See?
And when tax relief can be given, it ought to go to those who need it most and not go to those who need it least, as this Republican rich man's tax bill did when they passed it over my veto on the third try.
There you go. Now, I want to share with you some of the other things that Harry Truman was saying in this speech, because he goes on, and just the echo of history. And Obama's now starting to talk about the Republicans. He really needs to take a lesson from Harry Truman. Here's Harry Truman. This is 1948.
The first one of these tax bills they sent me was so rotten that they couldn't even stomach it themselves. They finally did send one that was somewhat improved, but it still helps the rich and sticks the knife into the back of the poor. Now, the Republicans came here a few weeks ago, and they wrote up a platform.
Now, this is really interesting. The Republican platform.
I hope you've all read that platform. They adopted a platform, and that platform had a lot of promises and statements of what the Republican Party is for and what they would do if they were in power.
This is called calling them out.
They promised to do in that platform a lot of things I've been asking them to do and that they've refused to do when they had the power.
This is the old you tell them, Harry. Just listen to this as he goes through the list.
The Republican platform cries about cruelly high prices. I have been trying to get them to do something about high prices ever since they met the first time.
This is Harry Truman running against the do-nothing Congress.
Now listen to this one. This one's equally as bad and as cynical. The Republican platform comes out for slum clearance and low rental housing. I've been trying to get them to pass that housing bill ever since they met the first time. And it's still resting in the Rules Committee, that bill is.
Just calling them out. Item.
The Republican platform favors equality of educational opportunity and the promotion of education. I've been trying to get Congress to do something about that ever since they came there. And that bill is at rest in the House of Representatives.
It's like nothing changed.
The Republican platform urges extending and increasing Social Security benefits. Think of that. Increasing Social Security benefits. And yet when they had the opportunity, they took 750,000 people off the Social Security roll. I wonder if they think they can fool the people of the United States with such poppycock as that.
He's ad-libbing here, by the way. He had bullet points, and he had the Republican platform in front of him, and he ad-libbed much of this speech.
There's a long list of these promises in that Republican platform, and before it's too late, I'd tell you about all of them.
He was ready to.
I've discussed a number of these failures of the Republican 80th Congress, and every one of them is important. Two of them are of major concern to nearly every American family. The failure to do anything about high prices and the failure to do anything about housing.
There you go. And, you know, and he goes on, just calling them out. Well, today, President Obama was calling them out, although he did say he can't do the Vulcan mind meld. I'll share that with you after the break, and we'll pick up your calls on Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. One of our callers today is going to get a copy, autographed copy, of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country by Tom Hartman, sent to you by Stamps.com.
America's calling, Harry Truman. Harry, you know what to do.
So the president today came out and said, the question was asked of him, basically. It was kind of a variation on the why aren't you a king? We actually do have kings here in the United States. We have kings and queens. We have nine of them. They sit about three blocks from where I'm sitting right now in the Supreme Court building, and wear black robes and claim the right to strike down laws and basically do what kings and queens do, you know, invalidate the actions of the people. This is not in the Constitution, by the way, but they do it. And, you know, this is what they're all about. But the president doesn't have that power. And, you know, can't really make Congress act. So, you know, one of the reporters today when he had his press conference said, well, why don't you just, you know, make them do something, or words to that effect. I don't have the exact quote of the question, but here's his response.
Most people agree that I'm being reasonable, that most people agree I'm presenting a fair deal. The fact that they don't take it means that I should somehow, you know, do a Jedi mind meld with these folks and convince them to do what's right. Well, you know, they're elected. We have a constitutional system of government. The Speaker of the House and the Leader of the Senate and all those folks have responsibilities. What I can do is I can make the best possible case for why we need to do the right thing.
Yeah, but he can't just, you know, bring them back. He can't just make it. He can't make them do things. Although Harry Truman did, you know, this is pretty incredible. Let me see if I can find this spot here.
My duty as president requires that I use every means within my power to get the laws the people need on matters of such importance and urgency. I am therefore calling this Congress back into session on the 26th of July.
And then the news reporter breaks in. This is a CBS report. Listen to this.
And with the announcement from the president that he's calling the Congress back into session on 26th July, the delegates rise almost as one man, some of them standing in their seats, and those state standards are waved frantically again over the heads of the delegates down on the floor. You can hear them in the background yelling and whistling at this announcement that Congress will be called back. The president holds up both hands to continue his dress, and now back to the rostrum.
Back to the rostrum. Here we go. Yeah, he's gonna call him back.
On the 26th day of July, which out in Missouri we call Turnip Day, I'm going to call that Congress back, and I'm going to ask them to pass laws halting rising prices and to meet the housing crisis, which they say they're for in their platform.
Give them hell, Harry.
At the same time, I shall ask them to act upon other vitally needed measures such as aid to education, which they say they're for. A national health program.
Whoa.
Civil rights legislation, which they say they're for.
That took until 1965.
An increase in the minimum wage, which I doubt very much they're for.
Keep in mind, this is 1948.
An extension of Social Security coverage and increased benefits, which they say they're for. Funds for projects needed in our program to provide public power and cheap electricity.
It's the Rural Electrification Administration, I think.
By indirection, this 80th Congress has tried to sabotage the power policy which the United States has pursued for 14 years.
Sabotage! These Republicans are trying to sabotage us. Come on, President Obama. Kick it up a little, would you? Marty in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Marty, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello, Tom. Hey, it's a tremendous honor to talk to you and all. I'm a first-timer. It's tough getting through to you.
Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening to AM 760. What's on your mind, Marty?
Well, this is what it's amazing because I have David McCullough's book here, Truman and all, and I've been going over it since listening to your show here the last couple of days, how many things, you know, from your recordings there you can read into in depth in the book here that David McCullough wrote, and how Truman certainly, you know, the little haberdasher from Independence, Missouri, right?
Yeah.
He was one tough individual.
He was.
Especially when you read about his early life.
Yep.
Now, the reason I called was I'll make it as brief as possible here. I mean, like anybody else, I think everybody in this country, you know, is going to be affected, with the exception of maybe the very, very, very elite. But, you know, I have like...
By the sequester, you mean?
Yeah, by the sequester. Yeah. I have a niece, just as an example. She's worked for Immigration Customs Enforcement for the last 28 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk frequently. She called me and said, you know what we're going to be doing? We're going to be opening up the detention centers downtown in Milwaukee to let people go because
right.
we can't keep them. We don't have. She started off in a department where they had 1,200 people. This is just in the Wisconsin, the northern area
mm-hmm.
of our country, with customs and immigration. They're down to under 200 in the field office.
Wow,
1,000 people have been cut over the last 10 to 12 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, just since Obama came into office, 700,000, I think is the number now. It might be 800,000 government employees, many of them in the states, but also federal employees as well, have lost their jobs, basically. And that's a half a point in unemployment right there.
Exactly. And this is what I want to say, just as a statement, I'll let you go. You know, since time immemorial, taxes, who have been the bane of our existence, have been part of the mortar that has created civilization and allowed infrastructures and all to rise up from the ground through you know, human endeavor.
Yeah.
We're not never going to get away from that.
No, Matthew, the guy who, you know, one of Jesus' disciples, he was a tax collector. And he found a higher calling. But it's been around for a long, long time. Marty, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 760. We will be right back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday. Senator Sanders will be here in a half hour for our Brunch with Bernie, 1 hour late today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I guess it's going to be Lunch with Bernie. Or, I don't know, Happy Hour with Bernie? Anyhow, we'll be back. Welcome back. Occupying the Media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Little bits of Harry Truman here. It's my kind of Harry Truman week. You know, I go through these streaks. We kind of went through an FDR year last year, but this seems like a Harry Truman year. Here's a little bit more from his 1948 acceptance speech when he was nominated to run for president of the United States and ultimately won, in large part, I think, because of this speech. What he's talking about here, by the way, is he says he's going to bring Congress back into session. The Constitution gives the president the power to say, you know, like President Obama said today, well, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, if they want to leave town, I can't just send the Secret Service down to grab them off the planes. Well, actually, he sort of can. He can call Congress into power or call Congress into session. It's right there in the Constitution. And Harry Truman said he's going to do it. And this is what he's going to ask.
I shall ask for adequate and decent law for displaced persons in place of this anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic law which this 80s Congress passed.
Anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic? I got to do some research on this one. I'm wondering what piece of legislation was that Congress passed in 1948. Very interesting.
Now, my friends, if there's any reality behind that Republican platform, we ought to get some action out of the short session of the 80th Congress. They could do this job in 15 days if they wanted to do it. And they'll still have time to go out and run for office.
But probably ain't going to happen.
They're going to try to dodge their responsibility.
Aha!
They're going to drag all the red herrings they can across this campaign. But I'm here to say to you that Senator Barkley and I are not going to let them get away with it. Now, what that worst 80th Congress does in a special session will be the test. The American people will not decide by listening to mere words or by reading a mere platform. They'll decide on the record as it has been written. And in the record is the stark truth that the battle lines in 1948 are the same as they were back in 1932 when the nation lay prostrate and helpless as a result of Republican misrule and inaction. In 1932, We were attacking the citadel of special privilege and greed. We were fighting to drive the money changers from the temple.
The banksters.
Today, in 1948, we are now the defenders of the stronghold of democracy and of equal opportunity. The haven of the ordinary people of this land, and not of the favored classes or the powerful few. The battle cry is just the same now as it was in 1932, and I paraphrase the words of Franklin D. Roosevelt as he issued the challenge in accepting his nomination at Chicago. This is more than a political call to arms. Give me your help, not to win votes alone, but to win in this new crusade and keep America secure and safe for its own people.
There you go. So Harry Truman, you know, running for office, and boy, did that guy know how to. It's quite remarkable. Mike, in Clarksville, Tennessee, you have some thoughts on how President Obama is in a position that Reagan was in the 80s? What's that?
Well, just very generally, he had the Senate. Was Republican, but he had a Democratic House.
Right.
And, you know, he was able to get through Reaganomics fairly easily. My question to you, because I was pretty young, I was born in 1980, is what kind of defiance did we see from those Democrats back there when Reaganomics was a vote away?
Well, I think that there wasn't a whole lot, actually. I mean, you know, although the Republicans were the gung-ho ones and the Democrats were sort of holding up the rear.
I think they passed a couple of those budgets, especially the big first tax cut that went, you know, the top bracket that went from 74
to 50.
That was done under reconciliation in the Senate. And, of course, you know, that means that it was the most important thing that they had to do. You know, it's just, I think Obama's got to change the rhetoric a little bit.
Yeah.
He's acting like it's the 1990s, but, you know, this kind of austerity that I guess we're seeing today with the sequester, this is dangerous.
It is. The Republicans are trying to do to the United States right now. With regard to the Reagan era, we should get on, and it's been a year or so since we've had him on, the fellow who wrote the book Tear Down This Myth. And I'm forgetting his name, but it's a brilliant book about the Reagan years. And he's a real scholar of that era. I am not. I can tell you the nuance of the arguments between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, but I frankly can't tell you very much about what went on between Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill.
It's that relationship you see with John Boehner and the president. I was watching before the State of the Union speech, they did a special about those. Have you talked on the program about those secret meetings between Boehner and Obama that Cantor didn't know about?
No, I didn't know that there were any that Cantor didn't know about.
Cantor didn't know about this for a while. They were trying to.
Oh, and that's why Cantor blew him up. That's why Boehner had to walk away from the negotiations. That's what you're talking about, the stuff that happened a year ago.
Right. Well, yeah, that led to the sequester in 2011.
Yeah, that led to exactly. Yeah, and Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I think the essence of what's going on here right now is what the Republicans are trying to do is they're trying to force the United States into becoming Spain, Greece, Portugal, Ireland. They're trying to force austerity, Italy. They're trying to force austerity down our throats in order to destroy the economy because they believe the bet that the Republicans have made, and they made this bet the night that President Obama was sworn into office. 4 years ago, there was a group of Republicans who met at the Caucus Room restaurant in a private room here in Washington, D.C. Actually, it was in the backside of the building that Louise and I used to live in. And the January 20th, 2009, as Obama was, you know, the night that Obama was sworn into office, as Ellen Ratner and I were going to the inauguration ball to dance with the president, the vice president, and whatnot. As that was going on, there was a group of a little less than 20 Republicans who were meeting in this conference room, and you know, led by Paul Ryan, and swore basically a blood oath to each other that they would do everything they could to crash the economy and blame it on Obama to prevent any sort of forward motion. At that time, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month, and they wanted to maintain that. They wanted to turn Barack Obama into Herbert Hoover. so that, because Herbert Hoover, I mean, you know, for 3 years, Hoover did nothing, and the country just sunk deeper and deeper and deeper into depression, which is what happens when the government doesn't fill in the holes of the business cycle, which is where I started this hour. And so these Republicans were going to force Obama to do the same thing. And what they didn't plan is that for the first 2 months and 1 week of his administration, until Ted Kennedy's seat was filled by Scott Brown, they did not have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And so a lot of good legislation, including a good stimulus package, got passed. But once they got control of the Senate, or not control, once they got 40 votes, did you see today or yesterday? 51 votes. I mean, this should be the lead story. And frankly, the president should be talking about this. Everybody should be talking about this. The Democratic plan to resolve the sequester got 51 votes in the Senate. There's 100 senators. 51 votes is a majority. 51 votes is enough to pass a law. Why is it not law? Why did it not get sent to the House for consideration? Because the Republicans filibustered it. Mitch McConnell said, sorry, you're going to have 60 votes. And I haven't heard the word filibuster in any of the news reports. I didn't see it in the New York Times. I'm seeing it nowhere. If this president doesn't start calling out the Republicans every time they filibuster the way Harry Truman did in the speech you just heard, where he went off at length about the Republican filibusters, if he doesn't start doing that, he's going to have a serious problem. It's time to tell Americans what's really going on here. Ed in Jeffersonville, Vermont. Hey, Ed, thanks for watching. You wanted to comment on Harry Truman?
You better believe it, pal, yeah. I grew up in listening to him, watching him on the news. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, and this stuff, you should be either giving our president some of the reels of film for him to watch,
mm-hmm.
or what would really be nice if you could have him on the show, like you have Bernie.
Yeah, wouldn't that be incredible? You know, brunch with Obama, brunch with Barack.
It would be nice.
I don't think it's going to happen, but I can tell you, I know that, you know, the White House does listen to the program and not just this program, of course, and they pay attention to these kind of things. And every now and then something seeps through, and every now and then a little bit of our rhetoric pops up someplace in a speech. So let's hope that it gets through. You know, Harry Truman laid out a great template, which is, you know, take names, kick ass,
yep.
and call. Yeah. So.
He did. I was born in 34, Tom.
Wow. So you remember it well, Ed.
Yeah.
That is,
yep.
those were amazing times. What's so amazing, Ed, my sense of it is that the battle that Harry Truman fought is the same battle that Barack Obama is trying to fight right now against the Republicans. Do you agree?
Yep.
Okay, so your experience comports with that. Thank you very much, Ed, for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Jeffersonville, Vermont. And much appreciated. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday. We're taking your calls. Bernie is going to be with us in 15 minutes. He's going to be an hour late. What should we call it? Brewskis with Bernie? Maybe? I don't know. Happy hour with Bernie? We'll call it brunch with Bernie. What the heck? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And one of our callers today is going to receive an autographed copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, complete with extensive quotes from Alexander Hamilton. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Dana Siegelman, the daughter of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, America's political prisoner, one of several, but one of our more prominent ones, and one of the few that was put in jail by Karl Rove. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. And Dana, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thank you so much. I just have to thank you and your listeners for being so dedicated and on this and following our moves, and we are mobilizing in Selma, Alabama this weekend. On Sunday, we're meeting at 12 noon at Brown Chapel. That's on Martin Luther King Street, mm-hmm. in Selma. And we're going to be commemorating Bloody Sunday. It's been about 50 years. In 1963, they started mobilizing for their right to vote, to push up against the white Supreme Council and the Ku Klux Klan, and my dad has been a part of this march for decades, and I'm going to be there in his stead. And so I just hope lots of people join us. It's not just about my dad, as you know. This is about the greater freedoms of Americans, getting prejudice out of our court system once and for all, putting safeguards in place so that people can't be targeted and wrongly convicted in the future. And anyway, I am very grateful to you for all of your wonderful work and your listeners for supporting us. And I do hope they'll share the petition. If you can't make it to the march, you can still get the word out. Go to free-dawn.org. That's free-dawn.org. Or just Google Free Dawn. It'll come right up. And you can share that on your Facebook page, Twitter account, email it out to friends. We do need your signature on the petition. And we do need to keep educating Americans that this has happened.
There you go. We're trying to get President Obama to sign a pardon for your dad, for former Governor Don Siegelman, who was basically put in jail by Karl Rove. I mean, that's how I would boil it down, and as political payback. And it's wrong. It's wrong that he's sitting in prison right now. It's wrong that you have to be, you know, out here talking about it. It is a blot on American democracy, and it is a victory for Karl Rove, which you know, gives me the total creeps every time I think of the guy. And we got to do something. Free-dawn.org is the website. And Dana, you are in Selma today, tomorrow, over the weekend. If people who are in the area who might be watching on Free Speech TV or listening on Sirius Satellite Radio or one of our stations down there, what can and should they do?
Well, I'm in Birmingham right now, which is an historic place in and of itself. This is, of course, where Martin Luther King Jr. was jailed. And he did speak from the 16th Street Baptist Church. So we've got some members of Congress that are coming in town that will be meeting there, going to the Civil Rights Museum, and then headed down to Selma on Sunday. I won't be with them per se. I do hope to shake some of their hands and encourage them to go to the president about this issue concerning Dad and others. But I will be in Selma early Sunday morning, hopefully attending church at Brown Chapel, and then outside passing out T-shirts and signs and walking with everyone as we cross the Peetus Bridge in commemoration of Bloody Sunday.
That's great. That's great. Dana Siegelman, free-dawn.org. Dana, good luck. Keep it up.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. It's always great to have you on. And anytime you want, anytime you've got something going on, just let us know. And you always have an open door here. Dana Siegelman with us. Ian in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Ian.
Hey, Tom. You kind of stole one of my one of two points I was going to make in that, you know, the Harry Truman clips were great, but we've got contemporary examples with Europe. You know, you mentioned Spain, Greece, others, and the austerity measures. I called about 2 weeks ago. I made a point. You partly agreed with it. I think there's more to it than just destroying the president. I think that the Republicans and the people that support these austerity measures are oligarchs, because it's not just their bottom line. Yet the difference between their bottom line and the lower and the middle class.
It's disaster capitalism.
Exactly.
You know, Naomi Klein wrote a book about it, Shock Doctrine. It's disaster capitalism. It's a strategy that was laid out by Milton Friedman back in the 30s. He tried it in Chile when he was hired by the bloody dictator Augusto Pinochet to come into his country and remodel it in that image. And it's what these Republicans are trying to do to the United States. It didn't work in Chile. It's not working here. It's not working in Europe. Every time they try it, they say it's for the public good. But what happens is that the plutocrats and the oligarchs get richer and richer and richer, and the middle class vanishes, not only gets poorer, but becomes less and less politically potent, less and less politically capable of getting things done. And that's their goal, is to render us politically impotent, to strip the middle class of political power by stripping the middle class of economic power, because the two go together. Go ahead.
Yeah, it seems so straightforward that investing in research and development, education, infrastructure, I mean, the long-term prognosis is rosy under those scenarios, and they're crushing.
I'm with you, Ian. Very well said. Thanks a lot for the call. Chris, listening on WHMP in Leverett, Mass. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Seeing as sequestration could be viewed as economic and political oppression, isn't there some provision in that nifty Patriot Act that would see this as domestic harm? And I wonder if the Pentagon and that big Homeland Security organization will get involved.
It's time for the Pentagon to invade Congress.
I'm just saying, is there something in the Patriot Act? I mean, because a lot of people do see this as economic and political oppression. For example, I myself, unfortunately, am badly physically disabled, and I feel terror at what might happen to me.
Sure.
And I did my part as a citizen, and I worked myself into this disability, and I really feel threatened.
Yeah.
So that's what made me think of this point that I wonder if Homeland Security would get involved because it is domestic.
It's a good point, and you are threatened, and all of us are threatened. But people like yourself, the more vulnerable among us, the people who the disabled, the elderly, the young, people who want to go to college, people who are just starting out in the job world, they're all threatened. And this is, once again, this is the Republican agenda. As Harry Truman said, they have always been the party of privilege and power from their inception virtually. I wouldn't say that was necessarily true of Abe Lincoln. But since Lincoln's assassination until this day, that's been what the Republican Party has been all about. Chris, thanks for the call. Good luck.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. And as promised, Senator Bernie Sanders here. An hour late, we'll call it, instead of brunch with Bernie, maybe happy hour with brewskis with Bernie. Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. I get your newsletter. I signed up for it over at sanders.senate.gov. A lot going on your plate.
There is a lot going on. Yes, there is. And I think most of the listeners know that sequestration begins today, and that is a real, real tragedy, to my mind, because it's a tragedy that goes beyond the people who will lose their jobs. Tom, I just came from an event at the Vermont National Guard, and these are people in Vermont. A lot of our people in Iraq and Afghanistan, some of these never came home. People really paid a price. And yet we're talking about furloughs now, people losing 20% of their pay. You're talking about Head Start being cut back, nutrition programs being cut back, et cetera, et cetera. So there's going to be a lot of pain, but of more significance than the loss of jobs in the middle of a recession is this Republican ideology that despite the fact that we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, despite the fact that the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well, that large corporations and Wall Street are enjoying record-breaking profits, the Republicans are absolutely adamant that they will not ask the wealthy and large corporations to pay a nickel more in taxes, and that the only way they want to do deficit reduction is by cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, student loans, nutrition, environment, you name it. And I think that is such a disastrous approach, both from obviously a moral perspective. I mean, we are seeing a middle class now disappearing. There was a piece in the paper today that talked about that while unemployment remains very high, many of the new jobs that are coming online and replacing the jobs that we've lost are low-wage jobs. So we've lost middle-class jobs and replacing them with low-wage jobs, which continues the trend of the median family income in this country in the last 10 years going down by $5,000.
Wow.
So in the midst of all of this growing disparity between the very, very wealthy and everybody else, the Republicans continue their attack on working families. And it's not just Republicans. They're sponsors. Groups like the Business Roundtable. It didn't get a whole lot of attention. But a couple of weeks ago, Business Roundtable is a group composed of the CEOs of every large corporation in America.
It's the 100 largest CEOs in the
country. 100 largest. Mm-hmm. Many of these corporations are enjoying huge profits. All of these CEOs receive fantastic salaries and compensation packages and retirement packages. They came to Washington and they said, we think you should raise the Medicare eligibility age to 70 years of age, and Social Security should start at 70 years of age. So you have these guys who are zillionaires, who have enormous wealth, enormous power, telling the United States Congress that we should continue to decimate working families, in this case, elderly people. So the class warfare, and I don't, you know, I use that word advisedly, but I can't use any other word. The rich are getting richer, and they use their wealth and their power to continue to attack working families. You know, these are the folks who have sent our jobs to China and to Mexico and to every other low-wage country. And now when it comes to paying taxes, they are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and in other tax havens. We recently, you know, mentioned on the floor of the Senate that the Bank of America has dozens and dozens of subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands. And their function, obviously, is to avoid paying taxes to the United States. And that is what many of these corporations are doing. So what we have got to do is to rally the American people and say, no, we do not want to become a second-class nation. We want to deal with our serious unemployment problem, which is really over 14%. We don't want to cut. We want to invest in our kids. We want to invest in the infrastructure. We want to transform our energy system. We want to create decent paying jobs in America. And we don't want austerity for working families while the wealthiest people do phenomenally well. So that is an issue of major concern. I am also now chairman of the Veterans Committee, and we're dealing with some of the very serious problems facing the veterans community. I think as many of your listeners who are veterans know, VA does a lot of things very, very well. We have a lot of very good hospitals and primary health care clinics that are doing a really good job for veterans, but we have our share of problems, and we're going to start addressing some of them, including the backlog. A lot of for a variety of reasons, a lot more people are applying for benefits. And while the VA is, in fact, dealing with a whole lot of claims more than they used to, they have a backlog which is significant because more people are applying. So we've got to deal with that. We have to deal with the issue of women in the military. Women are now going to be in combat positions. We have more and more women in the military. They've got to be treated with respect. They need their health care system as well. We have to deal with the very serious issues of post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, and that's a big issue. So a lot of issues that we're dealing with in the Veterans Committee. Barbara Boxer and I, a couple of weeks ago, introduced the most significant piece of global warming legislation, because at the end of the day, if we do not attack and reverse global warming and cut back significantly on greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to be looking at a planet which by the end of the century could be as much as 8 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is today. And what that will mean is that coastal cities around the United States and around the world could well be underwater. You will have more flooding, more droughts, more extreme weather disturbances like Hurricane Sandy, which will cause horrendous damage and cost us huge amounts of money in terms of rebuilding costs. So, you know, we got the sequestration, and we got the deficit reduction issue. We've got global warming. We've got veterans issues. We are working on postal reform. To my mind, in the middle of a recession where so many people are hurting, you don't talk about laying off more and more postal workers, and we have to protect those workers. So we got a table that's pretty full.
Yeah, yeah. Are you? What are your thoughts on how the sequestration thing is going to play out, and why is it that yesterday the Democrats actually got 51 votes in the Senate, which is, according to the Constitution, means the law passed for a plan to end sequestration, and yet the word filibuster. I have not seen it in any major news media, and the president didn't use the word.
Tom, you know, that's a good question, and it has to do with the media and so forth, and it has to do with this issue of filibustering. You know, we've talked about that many, many times, and everybody must know this. You know, when we grow up, as kids and we go to school, we learn that in America, majority rules. You know, if you're running for class president in the fourth grade and you get more votes than the other kid, you become class president, right?
Right.
But that somehow that rule does not apply in the United States Senate. For many, many decades, there was kind of like a gentleman's agreement that the filibuster would only be used in extreme circumstances. And by filibuster, it's not a question of people talking on the floor forever. More importantly is the amount of votes you need in order to move onto a vote on that issue. And since Obama has been president, the Republicans have used filibusters on on every piece, major piece of legislation, as well as many minor pieces of legislation. And the simple reality is it takes 60 votes to get it passed. So yesterday is a very good example. The majority rules, 51 votes carries the day, but not yesterday. And that's a whole other issue that we have to continue addressing.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We will be back with your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman Program. We're live. It's 4:15 on the East Coast.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more with Senator Sanders. Sanders.Senate.gov, by the way. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz for his newsletter. It's really worth your effort. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our Brunch with Bernie hour, 1 hour later than normal this week. And Senator Sanders, Vera had just called and was mentioning Pete Peterson and his efforts to privatize Social Security.
And Vera hit the nail right on the head. These guys are, by and large, cowardly people. You're going to hear very few of them getting up on television saying, I think we should cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They don't say that. What they say is, I believe in entitlement reform, which means the same thing. Now, Vera, let me just tell you something that will gratify you, is that you're not alone. Every single poll that has been done says that the American people do not believe that we should cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. They believe that the wealthiest people in this country should be paying more in taxes, that we should end these loopholes for large corporations. But the problem is that Pete Peterson and his other billionaire friends have so much influence over the White House and the Congress. This is not just Republicans. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but the president is also sympathetic to what is called a chain CPI. Again, nobody understands what a chain CPI is. What that means is they want to reconfigure how you determine cost of living increases, not only for Social Security beneficiaries, but for disabled vets. The result will be significant cutbacks in Social Security and benefits for disabled vets. They don't have the guts to say that. They call it a chain CPI. So I'll just give you one example of something which I find very gratifying. Just this last week, we had hearings with veterans organizations. And, you know, some people think, well, these veterans organizations are pretty conservative. Let me tell you something. Almost through an organization, they do not believe that we should be balancing the budget on the backs of disabled vets. They are exactly right. And the vast majority of the people of this country do not believe we should be balancing the budget on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. This is simply an issue. It's a political issue where big money, as Vera indicated, does not want to pay more in taxes. One out of four major corporations that make money pay nothing in taxes. We're losing $100 billion a year because these guys are slashing their money in the Cayman Islands. But rather than change those policies, they want to balance the budget by cutting programs that working families desperately need. In a nutshell, that is the issue that we are dealing with, and that's what sequestration is all about.
Andy in Teaneck, New Jersey, listening on WWRL, our New York City station. Andy, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Congressman Sanders, first of all, I want to thank you for all that you do. I'm about your age, and if I had to deal with those Republicans every day, I'd be in the hospital. I thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
And I wonder if these people are crazy, but my suggestion...
Andy, they ain't crazy.
Yeah, and I wrote a letter to the editor. It's going to be in my local paper soon. Why can't they're talking about taxes? They don't want taxes changed. $600 billion could be saved simply by changing the Medicare Part D to allow the government to negotiate the price of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So why isn't that spoken about?
All right, Andy. All right, Andy makes a good point. But let me just be very clear. These Republicans are not crazy. They are not crazy at all.
Crazy like a fox.
Right. They don't care. They're not stupid, and they're not crazy. They don't care. Listen, I have talked to Republicans, whose names I don't have to get into right now, who believe that if you don't have any health insurance, it's not a problem. The church will take care of you. A charity will take care of you. It's not a problem. These are people who, some of whom believe that Social Security not only should be privatized or cut, they literally believe it's unconstitutional. We should not have retirement programs for seniors. We should not have any federal health care, Medicare and Medicaid. At the end of the day, what they really want to do is undo all of the progress that we have made as a nation since the 1930s and bring us back to the time when corporations and wealthy people controlled the economic and political life of this country, and workers and middle-class families had very little security and very few rights. That is their vision, and that is their dream, to bring us back into the 1920s. Andy asked, well, can't we save substantial sums of money in Medicare if Medicare does what the Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense does? They negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry. Well, all over the world, healthcare systems negotiate prices with the drug companies, which is why I'm sitting an hour and a half away from the Canadian border. Prices for prescription drugs in Canada are substantially less than they are right here in Burlington, Vermont, and cheaper all over the world than they are in the United States of America. So Andy says, why can't Medicare negotiate prices? Well, of course they should, but they can't because in the George W. Bush passed Medicare Part D bill, language was put in there by the Republicans to protect the pharmaceutical industry so that we would not be able to do that. Obviously, we got to take that language out and do it. Andy is absolutely right.
Okay. We have just 1 minute to the break. Actually, that's not enough time for a question. Do you see any, in that 1 minute, Bernie, do you see any forward motion on this?
Any what?
Forward motion. Do you think things are going to get better?
Well, I think, you know, clearly the Republicans are in bad shape right now. They are tough. They are adamant in Washington, but they are losing more and more support from the American people. People see them as rigid. People see them as out of touch with the needs of ordinary Americans. So there's a lot of profound disgust with what's going on in Washington in general, but the Republicans are being hit harder by the American people quite correctly. So I think that if we continue to expose what the Republicans are about, as Vera mentioned, people don't know it. They don't know it. People say, well, you know, it's a plague on both your houses. People do not know, and the media does not do a particularly good job in reporting what right-wing extremism is about, and they are not effective in reporting the war against working families.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. 1 hour later than normal today, but we are here and we are live. It's 27 minutes past the hour in the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of our National Town Hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if you have not gone to sanders.senate.gov and signed up for Bernie's newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, you do not know what's going on in Congress. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a cheese. It's the Tom Hartman program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, 1 hour later than normal. It's our the East Coast 4 o'clock hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Bernie, you're still here?
I'm right here.
Okay, let's pick up some phone calls here. Paul in San Francisco, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'm calling because I wanted to thank you for the work you've been doing to save the Postal Service. I saw that you introduced Senate Bill 316, and part of which would repeal the 2006 pre-funding requirement. That's,
yep.
That's basically bankrupting the Postal Service.
Yep.
And I also saw that there's an House companion bill that Representative DeFazio introduced.
That is correct.
And both of them at this point are in committee. Is there anything that regular folks like me can do to help push these out of committee and get some action on them? Because they just seem so reasonable and so well thought out. And thank you again.
Well, Paul, thank you for calling. And the answer is absolutely. All over this country, people are supportive of the Postal Service. They know what an important role the Postal Service plays in our local economies, especially our rural economies. They do not want to see rural post offices shut down, and they don't want to see processing plants shut down, and many people do not want to see Saturday mail delivery ended. The debate, many people don't know this. Paul's point was that the major reason by far for the financial duress of the Postal Service, something like 80% of the financial problem, has to do with an incredibly onerous funding requirement that in a 10-year period, the Postal Service funds 75 years of future retirees' health care needs. In 10 years, 75 years of needs. And that is that requirement is unheard of in any other agency of government, unheard of in the private sector. And what we do in our bill, among many other things, is end that burden on the Postal Service. We also protect six-day delivery, and we establish the Postal Service does have to change. They have to be given the opportunity to raise new revenue, and there are ways that they can do that, because right now their hands are tied in many respects as to what kind of options they have to bring in revenue to help them. So we're working hard on this. We have a number of co-sponsors on it, and we're going to keep the fight to save the Postal Service.
Okay. Debbie in Maryville, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good afternoon, Tom and Senator Sanders. I'm calling today about Lockheed Martin. They have a contract with the United States for the F-22 bomber, which has not been fulfilled. And if the U.S. would just simply cancel that contract, it would save the United States over $1 trillion+. So, excuse me, rather than having hundreds of thousands of Americans go through this austerity, if you just cancel that contract for that Lockheed Martin F-22, they've been feasting on at the U.S. wartime table for decades, and just cancel it. And if they have a problem with it, you can just tell them what Senator Boehner wants to tell everybody in this country. We're broke.
Debbie, thanks for your question. I apologize for not being all that familiar with the F-22. I'm not on the Armed Services Committee. But this I do know. One of the scandals with regard to defense spending is time after time after time, companies like Lockheed Martin and others come in and they say, well, we'll build you this plane. We'll build you this weapon system for X amount of dollars. We'll build it for $1 billion. And then, because the Defense Department has not been vigorous in holding these people accountable, they come back a few years later and say, well, we told you it would cost $1 billion, but it really is going to cost you $3 billion. So the cost overruns that we see throughout the Department of Defense are really outrageous, and it's part of a plan. They come in cheap, and they end up doubling or tripling, whatever it may be, significantly increasing the cost of production. So you make a very good point, Debbie, and I think taking a hard look at defense spending and ending those types of abuses is one way that we can and should go forward in deficit reduction.
Okay. Patty in Towson, Maryland, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Patty, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Fine.
Great. Senator Sanders, thank you for your service. My son's a big fan. He's 14 now. We met at the Burlington Airport in when he was like 9 years old, and he knew who you were right away. Big fan of yours. But I wanted to ask, I understand that the sequestration is actually a series of cuts to the budget increases coming up for this fiscal year. And I wanted to see if I'm understanding that correctly. And if that's so, then when do they actually start taking effect? Are we on a budget now, or are we still on continuing resolution? Trying to understand the details.
I know. It gets complicated, Patty, and it is hard to keep up with. No, the continuing resolution does not end until the end of this month. So we're not on that, and that's going to be another whole debate, or else the government shuts down. What this is about, what sequestration is about, is an agreement reached by the super committee who were asked to come up with a deficit reduction plan, and they failed. And this was the alternative, and the alternative was $1.2 trillion over a 10-year period. That's $110 billion a year. Given the fact that we're 3 months into the year already, this applies, I think, to 8 or 9 months. It'll be about $85 billion, half military, half non-military, including Head Start, education, and other important programs in addition to military. That goes into effect today, but it's not going to mean that everything happens today. It's going to be spread out over a period of time. Some of these cuts will come sooner, some will cut later. Many government agencies right now are beginning to implement some of the changes, but it'll depend agency by agency. You know, my hope is that in fact we can reach an agreement where the Republicans see the light and understand that we need revenue, and that we can come to an agreement to end the sequestration.
Pete in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Pete, thanks for listening. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, a company called the Scooter Store was raided by the FBI last week, and that was reported in the press, allegedly for Medicare fraud on a massive scale, if true. Is it not time to start taking these companies to trial rather than letting a settlement just be a cost of doing business?
Pete, that's a good question. In general, I would agree with you. I don't know. I suppose that the Department of Justice has to look at it case by case. There is an enormous amount of Medicare fraud. There is no question about it. Sometimes it's small companies. Sometimes it's doctors. And sometimes, by the way, it is large pharmaceutical companies who are ripping off both Medicare and Medicaid. And you're right in saying that I know with the pharmaceutical industry, some of the settlements with some of the biggest drug companies have resulted in settlements rather than acknowledgement of guilt. And I am troubled by that. If you're ripping off the federal government intentionally, you should be found guilty. They should take you to court. You should be fined. And whether or not you should be able to continue to sell your products for the federal government is a question that should be considered.
Corky in Hilton, New York.
Oh.
You're on the air with Corky?
Hello, Senator Sanders.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I was hoping that you could stay strong for this sequester, because let them hit their big donors. That's the military complex. We can withstand some of these cuts. But they're coming after the Democratic voters, and I would submit to you that their biggest campaign donors are the military complex contractors. And they're going to come crying and screaming in a couple months when these guys start getting on their case.
The Republicans.
It's about time we stand up to these guys.
Well, Corky, if the point is that military contractors have enormous power, you're absolutely right. We have seen, among other things, a revolving door in Washington where many generals and admirals leave the United States Armed Forces, end up working for some of these companies. They have a lot of power, and they have a lot of money. As I've said earlier, believe that at a time when we are now spending three times as much as we did in 1997 on defense, I think we can make judicious cuts in military spending and do it in a way that's wise. The problem with the sequestration is it cuts across the board. It is not wise. It is not looking at priorities. It is not looking at wasteful systems that might be eliminated where other systems, in fact, or parts of the military budget might be strengthened. So it's a bad way, clearly, to do business. So I oppose the sequestration. I'm a member of the budget committee, and I hope we can come up with a budget which is a sane budget, which deals with deficit reduction by cutting military spending and asking the wealthy and large corporations to stop paying their fair share of taxes.
We will be back with more Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, in just a moment. Be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter, which keeps you up to date on what is going on in Congress and around the country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And one of our callers today is going to receive a free autographed copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, sent out by Stamps.com. It's the book Bernie read from the floor of the Senate. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, an hour later than normal this week. And Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. Jason in Denver, you're on the air with Bernie.
Okay, I just wanted to say to the first, Bernie, thank you so much for your leadership in the Senate and all that you do. I love your the email that comes in. I read it all the time, and I definitely follow what's going on. I just had a question for you. You know, especially out here in Colorado, and I used to live in Arizona, a lot of conservatives who are hardworking people don't make a lot of money. They hate the government.
Right.
And they despise the government. You know, private sector can do better, you know, all that jazz.
Right.
I just wanted to know how many people, and this is also to you, Tom, how many people do you guys interact with, would you say that, you know, fit that mold? They absolutely hate the government. They, you know, they work. They make $20,000 a year. They might live with their mom. They might, you know, they have a poverty level income, you know, so I just wanted
to know.
Here's
what's going on, Jason. You raise a very, very important issue. It's one that over the years Tom and I have often discussed. The American people, the middle class, the working class of this country is being battered. Real wages are going down. Unemployment is far too high. We're losing jobs to China, et cetera, et cetera. And people are angry. And what right-wing politicians have been successful in doing is in certain parts of the country, not in other parts, not in Vermont by and large, for example, but in certainly in the South and in other parts of this country, they've taken this anger and they say, you're working longer hours for low wages. You know what the cause of that is? It's the government. It's the government. And, you know, because in many of these states, there is not a progressive political opposition to say, excuse me, wasn't the government that caused the Wall Street crisis of 2008? That wasn't the government. It's not the government that's shipping your jobs to China. It's not the government that's breaking your unions. It's not the government that's charging you 25% interest on your credit card. Yeah, we should make the government better. No question about it. Government, you know, does a lot of things that are dumb. But we can make it better. But what these guys, the anti-government people, for all intent and purposes, end up representing the wealthiest people and the largest corporations in this country. And our job is to really focus our discussion on the needs of working people and start doing a much better educational effort than we have done up to date.
Pat in Oswego, New York. Pat, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator. Thank you very much for taking my call. I want to tell you first and foremost, I watched your entire talking filibuster, as much of it that was broadcast. And I enjoyed it. I appreciated it. Thank you very much for doing it. My question is there any way that is it public knowledge these people that send in the silent filibuster? They have their aides call it in or whatever.
Right. We are making, I believe, some progress in that. What Pat is talking about is, and I think we have made some progress. Pat is saying is that a staffer representing a senator can call in and say, we're putting a hold on that bill, which means you have to get 60 votes. So I think what we're moving toward, one of the recent reforms, as I understand it, is that senator himself or herself is going to have to come down to the floor and say, I want to start talking about this, and I'm going to filibuster it. So
how do
you
we,
can't do it through a staff person. I think that is one of the reforms that recently has been developed.
And I should note for our caller that your filibuster is now available in book form. It's called The Speech.
Right.
By Bernie Sanders. Bernie, just a quick question from me here, if I may. How do we find out who put the filibuster on yesterday when 51 votes said, yes, let's fix the sequestration?
I think that would not be a secret. I mean, I think that one, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was the leader, Mitch McConnell.
Probably Mitch McConnell. He's probably actually probably.
I mean, that's a big vote, and everyone's watching it, and so it wouldn't surprise me if that was the leadership. But on some of the other pieces of legislation which the nation is not focused on, you could just have somebody saying, hey, you know, I'm going to filibuster it, and I want 60 votes.
Okay. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I'd like to thank you both for your work. I have a fun thing for you to do, Senator.
I can use some fun things.
I would like you to approach the Congress, particularly the Republican Congress, and say you have an answer for entitlements. Have them do the same thing in private industry that they did with the post office. Have corporations put up 75 years of money in advance over a 10-year period, and they would have no excuse to say no to that because it must be a good thing. They've done it to the post office.
Well, that is an interesting point, Howard. Needless to say, I don't think I would get all that much support from our Republican friends. But Howard is pointing out, and he's absolutely correct, is there is no entity in the United States of America, no government agency, no private sector company, no corporation that has an onerous burden like the U.S. Postal Service in terms of pre-funding future retiree health care needs. None. And that is causing somewhere around 78% of the financial problems of the Postal Service. And Howard makes a good point.
Bernie, just 1 minute to the end of the hour. Thoughts, final thoughts for the day?
Yeah, I wanted to give, you know, as we look at the first day of sequestration and our Republican friends saying, my goodness, we just don't want to raise any more revenue. Tom, let me give you just one example of how you can raise revenue. In the year 2010, Bank of America set up over 200 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands, which has a corporate tax rate of zero. As a result of that, the Bank of America did not pay a nickel in federal income taxes, and in fact, had a rebate from the IRS to the tune of $1.9 billion.
Wow.
Now, what do you think? You think we might want to address that issue before we cut education?
I think that would be golden.
Social Security.
That would be golden. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And aside from, you know, a few rants that I've had and Bernie on here, I want to emphasize that one point that I opened the show with, and for those of you who were not listening 2 hours ago, there was a time in America when we all understood that the one job of government was to fill in the craters that happen when the business cycle tanks. And it not only was a job of government to help out average people, but it was also a job of government to help out business. That there is a business cycle, that it's intrinsic to capitalism, that it's been observed and written about for centuries, that, in fact, people try to predict it. There's a whole science and pseudoscience and, you know, variations on everything from astrology to Well, I mean, there's all kinds of theories about what causes, you know, every 10, 15, 20 years, thereabouts, sometimes 5 years, sometimes 30 years. Nobody knows for sure. But why is it that we periodically have these little crashes in the business cycle where you got a couple of bad years? I mean, there's a lot of theories about it. But, you know, setting all that aside, since we don't really know for sure what causes these dips in the business cycle, the consensus has been since the George Washington administration, and it only wasn't done during the Herbert Hoover administration, and Republicans are trying to keep Obama from doing it now, the consensus has been that when the business cycle fails, when capitalism fails, when there's not full employment in the economy, when the average working person is in trouble, that government steps in, and it does it with borrowed money. And it spends that money into the economy to boost things back up again so that, you know, on the other side of that failure in the business cycle, people still have their jobs. And that when times are bad, government borrows and spends. And when times are good, government increases taxes to pay back the money that it borrowed when times were bad. It's really simple. It's like a stabilizer on a boat or an airplane. It just, you know, it fills in the bumps. It's like caulk. And we all used to understand this. This used to be conventional wisdom. Until Reagan came along and said, government can't do anything good. And for 32 years now, 33 years, we've had Americans who have bought that nonsense. I mean, yes, there's a lot of things none of us want government doing. I don't want government making the computer that or the camera that I'm looking at or the microphone that I'm talking on or the clothes that I'm wearing. I mean, yeah, that'd be dumb. But there are things that government actually does better than private industry. Government runs police departments better than private industry. Government runs prisons better than private industry. Why? Because government runs schools better than private industry. Why? Because when government runs them, they run them for the public good. When private industry runs them, they run them to make a buck, which means that they've got to skim 10, 20, 30% off the top. They've got to figure out a way to skim that off the top. And so if you're comparing dollar for dollar, what you're going to find consistently is that government, you know, Medicare operates on a 2% overhead. Big health insurance companies, 30% overhead. Somebody's got to pay the CEO $1 billion. Yes, I actually said that with a B. Two CEOs in a row at United Healthcare made $1 billion with a B, 1,000 million. Somebody's got to pay that. Somebody's got to pay for the corporate jets and the gold faucets in the executive bathroom and the $300 bottles of wine that they can deduct from their income taxes. And I mean, you know, with dinner, and somebody's got to pay for that. And in government, basically, I mean, you know, somebody has to pay the salaries of the bureaucrats. Well, fine. Social Security's never missed a check. You got a bunch of people who work for 30 years and get a pension, and God bless them. But they're not making $5 million a year, $50 million a year, $500 million a year. They might be making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, but it's simple. It might, or 30 or 40 or 50, frankly, I don't know. But it's in that, it is, you know, these are things that government should do. And in addition, government, you know, there's all this stuff that needs to be done, bridges and roads and infrastructure and all kinds of stuff. Reagan basically stopped all that. We're no longer going to invest in America because if we let the country fall apart, private business will step in. So we let our country fall apart for 30 years. And guess what? While we were letting our country fall apart, the South Koreans built a state-of-the-art internet system. So literally every home in South Korea has a T1 line going into it, the fastest internet connection you can get. The Chinese built 5,000 miles of high-speed rail. So you can get the equivalent of New York to Miami or New York to Chicago in about 8 hours on a train. The Germans solarized a third of the houses in their country. While we were letting our country fall apart because we were all believing in Reaganomics and the idea that government can't do anything good, governments all over the world have been building out infrastructure in such a way that businesses will come in and say, I would love to do business here. You kidding? Instant high-speed internet access and good power systems, great transportation, good schools. Singapore, best schools in the world. It's a bit of a dictatorship, but they got the best schools in the world. It's a free enterprise dictatorship. Libertarians love it, I suppose. But the point is that in Singapore, their teachers are paid the same as their doctors. Finland, second best outcome, school outcomes in the world. They also pay their teachers the same as their doctors. Noticing a trend? Meanwhile, you've got the Paul Ryans and the Scott Walkers and the Rick Snyders and the Rick Scotts of the world who are all, and the Marco Rubios and the, you know, the list, everybody on Fox News, Fox so-called news, saying, oh, yeah, teachers are what? They're making how much? They're making $40,000, $50,000. Oh, we can't have it. These teachers should be working for free. They love kids, right? Give me a break. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, let's get back to Anything Goes Friday. Hey, Dave,
hi,
what's
Tom,
up?
How you doing? Thanks a lot for everything you do. I'm a big fan. I always watch your show. I'll get right to it here. I was watching on Tuesday, and you were debating a lady from the Manhattan Institute about she was taking a position against subsidizing green energy.
Yes.
And after, you know, we are and always have been subsidizing the fossil fuel industry.
Sure. We have been since the late 19th century. Yeah.
Yeah. The point I'd like to make is that the corporations that run the oil, gas, and coal know that they're polluting. They even admit it, and they know that this can't go on forever, but it seems like their goal is to make as much money as they can while they can, even if it's to the detriment of the general public. And got to remember that the purpose of a corporation by law is to make a profit for their shareholders, which is not necessarily a bad thing, unless it goes against the general public good. And this is a fact, but, you know, I think when we talk about energy, you know, I think this should really be treated as part of the public domain, whether it's in a partnership with the private sector or not. But, you know, all new innovation, you know, talking about the green energy, and it's going to go through a period of growth, and it's going to have a price tag. But I think in the long run, it's going to be a win-win for everybody.
Yeah. And, no, and it's worked. It's worked for governments all over the world to nationalize their energy systems, and and it should work for us. But
well, she talked about China doing more pollution with coal than we do, and which is probably true. But I think we've got to take the lead.
Well, beyond that, you know, China's doing a heck of a lot more with solar than we are. China has the fastest growing solar industry and the fastest rate of solarization of any country in the world. So, yes, they are building coal-fired power plants. They're also building solar plants like there's no tomorrow, and they're building solar panels, and they're solarizing places. So, you know, basically they're just growing like crazy. Comparing them to us, where they're investing in their infrastructure, they're investing in their people, they're investing in education, and we're saying, oh, we're too broke, we're poor, we can't invest in it anymore. America's glory days are over. You know, it's Republican time now. It's you know, just ask a billionaire for a job. Dave, thanks a lot for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's time for Americans to wake up and see what is really going on. The billionaire agenda is never going to be the best thing for this country.
I'm sick of the sequestration. It's given me some frustrations. I'm down on the sequestration. It's stopping the whole damnation.
Well done, Rocky Mountain Mike. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ferret only slightly unbalanced. We were just hearing a story from a woman who had cancer, and so her health insurance company is now trying to price her out of the market. And yeah, we, you know, it's another year and a half until Obamacare really prevents that you know, that from happening, and provides, you know, some kind of government backstop for everybody. I'm not an expert on this. There may be something over the shorter term. Wendell Potter is really the guy to get on about that, and we get him on periodically just to talk about these things. But in any case, oh, there we go. Oh, it didn't freeze up. It was just a mouse freezing. Jimmy in New Iberia, Louisiana, says you want to disagree with me.
Well, I'm not going to say. I just started listening to you, Tom. I'm not going to disagree with you right off the, you know, right from
feel
the start.
Free.
But, you know, and I see that, you know, a lot of our infrastructure needs improving, but to the government, you know, You know, for one, it's like I'm commuting right now, and I prefer to commute. I don't want to, you know, like a light rail or what have you.
But hang on just a second, Jimmy. Are you commuting with a rocket ship, or are you using a public road that was built as part of the public infrastructure, going over public bridges?
I'm using a public road.
Okay, then you're using the infrastructure just the same as if you were using high-speed rail. What's the difference?
Right, but what I'm saying...
Now, how would you feel if that road was so full of potholes that you had to replace your suspension every 6 months, which is the case in countries that are run by libertarians, where they don't think that the government should play a role in running, you know, in fixing the roads?
Well, I mean, you have to fix the roads. But
wait a minute, Jimmy. You're starting to sound like a socialist here. You think the government should pay to fix the roads?
Well, the roads are actually fixed by the states.
Right. So the state government should fix the roads. You want?
Well, yeah. If we do fix them when they get bad enough.
Jimmy, you're a socialist.
No, I'm not a socialist.
Sure you are.
That's how Louisiana has it set up.
You want Louisiana taxpayers to pay for your roads so that you can drive on it.
We vote for that normally.
Yes, that's right. We have a democratic republic. You're absolutely right. We vote for those things, and Republicans call that socialism, and they say that road should be privately owned and you should pay a toll every time you use it, and then that toll money will be used by the corporation to fix the road, and the profit that they make will turn somebody into a billionaire.
No, that's only when it comes from the federal government that it's like that. Each state and parish, county, what have you, they vote on what, you know, they want to fix this road, build this road, whatever.
Jimmy, you know, unless you're on a county road, if you're on a state road, and I don't know how they're labeled in Louisiana, where I grew up in Michigan, you know, the county roads sometimes had a letter to designate the county, or there was no letter, there was just a number. The state roads were SR, or the highways were I, as in Interstate, I-95.
Right.
If you're on a state road, it's about half paid for by the federal government.
Right. I know the federal dollars go into it. But I guess what my point is I'm doing the worst I've ever done financially.
Right. You should thank the Republicans for that.
I graduated college in 96, and this year alone, they cut with these tax increases that started in January. Between my wife and I, that was $400 gone out of our checks.
Right, and that actually wasn't a tax increase. What it was the end of a two-year tax cut on Social Security taxes. So you're just paying what you used to pay before Obama pushed through a tax cut. The Republicans did not want to continue that tax cut, and so it went away. Because that was a tax cut for working people. Now, the Republicans want tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. In fact, they're saying that they're going to lay off air traffic controllers, and they're going to lay off doctors and nurses before they will see any the buffer rule is what the president has proposed. He said, you know, Warren Buffett says that, you know, his secretary pays 39% income tax, federal top income tax, and he pays a maximum of 20% because he's a billionaire. And Warren Buffett says that no billionaire should pay less in income taxes than his secretary. And the president said, let's do that. Let's just do that. And the Republicans are like, no way, no way.
Well, I don't – when the Republicans were running, all I can say is I was doing better. Even health care, it just
really
has been going up, gas goes up. Groceries now, it's unreal, the cost of it.
Yeah.
And
you think the Democrats are responsible for that?
How
is that
not working than working? That's where the problem lies.
Right. So in other words, private industry, the private sector, the so-called capitalism free market is not working right now.
No, private industry is working. It's just they're taking money from everyone who is working to give to everyone who's not working.
No, private industry is taking jobs to other countries. And when the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi passed a law out of the House of Representatives that said that we're no longer going to give tax breaks to Mitt Romney's companies when they ship jobs overseas. Instead, we're going to give tax breaks to companies that bring jobs back from overseas. Republicans in the United States Senate filibustered that. They would not let it go into law because they did not want the economy to get better while there was a Democrat in the White House. The Republicans have stopped over 300 pieces of legislation, every single one of which would have increased your pay or decreased your taxes, Jimmy, because you're a middle-class working person making under $325,000 a year. And the Republicans, every single one of their efforts, including Paul Rudgeon's Brian's budget, would have made life harder for you and would have made life a whole lot easier for people making over $325,000 a year. And don't believe me, look it up. It is there for anybody to see. The Republicans talk a good game, but what they have been doing is everything they can to kneecap you and anybody else who's in the middle class so that you will blame the president. I'm serious. You gotta stop watching Fox News. They're making you crazy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
No offense. I didn't mean that Jimmy was crazy. I mean, you know, watching Fox News over time just makes you uninformed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's just take some random moment here and listen to Harry Truman.
In the field of labor, we needed moderate legislation to promote labor-management harmony. But Congress instead passed that so-called Taft-Hartley Act, which has disrupted labor-management relations and will cause strife and bitterness for years to come if it's not repealed, and the Democratic platform says it ought to be repealed.
There you go. And it was Taft-Hartley that Rick Snyder used to do the right to work for less in Michigan. And that every other governor that has put right to work for less into place did it based on Taft-Hartley. And there's Harry Truman trying to rip them, saying, you know, we need to repeal that. We still need to repeal it. I mean, it's absolutely an abomination.
I tried to strengthen the Labor Department.
Now, let me just pause, Harry, for a moment here. I don't know if you know this or not, but there are supposed to be five members of the National Labor Relations Board appointed by the president for it to make decisions and, function. And they have to be approved by the Senate. And the four of those appointments were being filibustered by Republicans in the Senate. And so Obama recess appointed them. And a court in the last month or so has said those recess appointments are invalid because the court was not actually in recess. It's First Circuit Court, the D.C. court here. I believe it was the First Circuit Court who said this. It will go to the Supreme Court. But it looks like right now the Labor Department here is paralyzed. The Labor Department, which is the only thing that stands between your employer screwing you and you being able to fight back. And so the Republicans have devastated the Labor Department. And over the last 10 years, 12 years, they have cut its funding consistently over and over and over again. And basically all the way back to Reagan, they've been on a crusade to cut the Labor Department. The last good Secretary of Labor who really was able to get stuff done was Robert Reich during the Clinton administration. But since then, it's been just an uphill road because the Republicans have refused to do any kind of funding. That was before Newt Gingrich brought the Republicans into power in the House of Representatives. So anyhow, here's Harry Truman talking about what the Republicans did in the 80th Congress back in the Congress of 1946 to 48 to the Labor Department.
The Republican platform of 1944 said if they were in power, they'd build up a strong Labor Department. You know what they've done to the Labor Department? They've simply torn it up. There's only one bureau left that's functioning, and they cut the appropriation on that, so it can't hardly function. I recommended an increase in the minimum wage. What'd they get? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
There you go. So, you know, enough Harry Truman. Actually, Myron wants to talk about Harry Truman. Hey, Myron, thanks for calling. Thanks for watching us there here in Pennsylvania. What's up?
Well, Tom, I want to thank you for letting me speak out about one of my probably my favorite presidents, although Roosevelt rated high in me. I think that Harry had so much courage in having to make that decision to use the atomic bomb in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that I really got, well, there's several things I got a kick out of Harry. And one of them was that in the election in 48, the newspapers around here come out the next morning saying,
Dewey one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Harry Truman famously was photographed holding the Chicago Sun-Times, or the Chicago Sun, I guess it was called back then, saying Dewey wins. Yeah. Yeah. So Myron, you liked Harry Truman. That's good to know. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching. Debbie in San Jose, California. Hey, Debbie. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. I really am sorry I missed Senator Sanders, because although it's a bit off topic from what he was discussing today, I really wanted him to hear this.
You just need to, Debbie, I can't convey a message. You just need to, you know,
Let me make my statement, and I'll get off the phone and listen to your response. I'll be real quick. Okay, I just wanted to say that, you know, the issue is that of the existing and ever-expanding police state apparatus of the war on terror. I mean, right now, our right to freedom of speech, the right to free assembly, the right to a fair trial are no longer protected by law. And basically, in the name of Homeland Security, almost any action, speech, or protest against the government can be construed legally as terrorism.
Yeah, no, I am with you, and I totally oppose the Patriot Act. I think it needs to be dismantled. I want to know, thank you, Debbie, for the call. I want to know what was the deal back during the Bush administration after 9/11, when the Patriot Act, all of a sudden the Patriot Act just comes out of nowhere. Well, these guys have been planning this for a long time. And it drops onto the desk of Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle. It has to get out of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. The Democrats controlled the Senate at that time. It has to get out of Pat Leahy's office. You know, he was the head of the Judiciary Committee. Patriot Act had to get through that committee, and then it had to go to Tom Daschle, who was the Senate Majority Leader. The Democrats controlled the Senate, so he was the guy who would bring bills to the floor or decide to bring bills to the floor for a vote. It had to get through these two men, and both of them were saying, nah, don't think so. That's a bridge too far, this Patriot Act stuff. And only two politicians in all of America got anthrax in the mail, right in the middle of those negotiations. Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy. They had to evacuate their Senate offices. They had to leave behind all their paperwork. They had to do their work, you know, off-site. And during that time, the Patriot Act came up for a vote, and they, at that point, I think were scared to death, frankly. I mean, somebody tried to kill those two men. And we still don't know who. The Bush administration, you know, we're not going to look into that so much. There's a story there. Someday we're going to know that story. Just like, you know, someday we knew about the Gulf of Tonkin. Someday we learned about the USS Maine. Someday we're going to learn about that. Dorothy in Plattsburgh, New York. Hey, Dorothy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk to Bernie, too, but I'm just as glad you're playing Harry Truman and labor. Last week, I'm reading an article that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Richard Trumka of the AFL-CIO, and this has to do with immigration, they were looking for input, agreed that the visas should be expanded for low-skilled workers, visas. We don't have enough low-skilled workers here right now who are unemployed. I hear about it every day that the people that are on unemployment don't have the high skills to get any jobs. And yet here is unelected officials doing the recommendations to expand low-skilled visas. So what? The president asked for a raise in
the minimum wage. Yeah.
And they're already saying, well, you can't pay more for those low-skilled jobs. So we'll bring in more low-skilled workers so the minimum wage will never go up.
Could be, Dorothy. And the minimum wage is going to go up as a matter of political will, I think, more than anything else. And the minimum wage going up would be a good thing for the United States. It would be a good thing for low-skilled workers. I am personally opposed to expanding our workforce in any way during a time of less than full employment. And there's a variety of ways that we can solve that. The government could become the employer of last resort. Then a lot of these debates would recede into the background, because wages would be bid up as a result of competition between employers. That's one. Another one would be we could pass trade laws that make it more expensive to manufacture overseas than to manufacture here, and, you know, with tariffs or with a VAT tax. And so people start manufacturing, you know, companies start manufacturing here. We could change the way that we deal with the H-1B visas. I think that you have to, an employer should have to prove, as we used to have to prove before the Reagan administration. You have to prove that you actually cannot find an American who's capable of doing that job, and which is a very rare situation before you can get somebody on a visa. But, what you're looking at is the result of the power of lobbying, the power of money, and we need to do something about that. And that's why movetoamend.org is so important. Start a local chapter in your town in Plattsburgh, New York, Dorothy. Go to movetoamend.org and start, you know, and join that movement to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people, money is not speech, and let's take the power away from the whole damn bunch of them who want to corrupt our democracy and basically, you know, damage, impoverish the middle class. Thanks a lot for the call, Dorothy. Ziggy in Issaquah, Washington. Hey, Ziggy, we've got a minute to the break. You got a letter from Rand Paul, really?
Yeah, I love your guys' show. I'll try to make this quick. I just think it's hilarious. It's a 501c4 PAC from Senator Rand Paul, National Association for Gun Rights.
Oh, man.
This made it into the house of a convicted felon on manslaughter, and it's a money grab and an official sovereignty survey, and he's fighting for gun rights for the big UN grab where they're going to come and take our guns.
Oh, the UN is going to come and take our guns now.
The UN, and he's worried, and this is going down in March. And I think it's hilarious that, once again, this was addressed and in the name of somebody who was convicted of manslaughter and is a felon and has no gun rights.
That's amazing.
Which is my father, and I don't want to get into that, and he's a good man, but...
Yeah, yeah.
But I find it interesting they will go and...
Well, and what's really tragic is that because the United States senator is signing off on these wacky conspiracy theories about the UN wants to take away your gun, it makes it a whole lot harder to, you know, I remember when I went into that gun store in Mason, Michigan, back when Obama first became president, and the guy started yelling at me about the, you know, that N-word in the White House is going to take away your guns. And I'm like, you don't have any proof of that. Now you got a U.S. senator saying this kind of stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it just makes it a whole lot harder to talk back with some rationality when you've got an irrational, crazy man in the United States Senate, in the form of Rand Paul. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the various people at all the various companies that syndicate this program, Dow Global on commercial radio, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial radio, CRN Network on cable systems nationwide, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV as television, and all the cable providers who carry our show also as television, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey! To Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our radio and television stations, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you so much. It is appreciated. Paul, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, first I wanted to let you know, like a year ago I had problem with depression. I had a stint in the hospital and stuff. And one thing that always went around in my head was your line, despair is not an option. So I kind of owe you a thank you for your
You're welcome. Let me tell you, though, Paul, I stole that from Bernie Sanders. He said that on my show about 8 or 9 years ago. He came on, and I was like, Bernie, what do we do? And he says, despair is not an option, Tom. And I just, you know, but you're welcome. But you really need to thank Bernie.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say earlier this week I was listening to Minnesota Public Radio, and they were talking about the prison situation. And I haven't heard you talk about this lately. I'm sure you know quite a bit about it. It wouldn't surprise me. But they were talking about how there's more incarcerated people in the U.S. than Russia and China combined. The average stay in prison is 5 years, and the cost per inmate is basically a pretty damn good.
It's about what it costs to go to Harvard.
College
it's
education.
$40,000 to $50,000 a year. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought that, you know, I wanted to bring that up just to show, you know, a different perspective on just where, you know, where all the money is. And
yeah, all these numbers really started exploding, Paul, during the Reagan administration when, you know, Reagan came along with the idea that the government, any government, can't do anything well, that only private industry can do things well, and we started privatizing prisons. And now we've got a private prison industry that is a multi-billion with a B, multi-billion dollar a year industry that has enough profit that they can spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying and campaign contributions and, you know, trying to influence legislation all around the country. And the consequence of that is the three strikes you're outlaws, the harsher prison penalties. They're looking for new things to criminalize. They are one of the major forces that are pushing back against the decriminalization of pot. You know, the drug war is a major profit center for the private prison industry. These people make money off imprisonment. And you're right. This is the prison nation. We have more people in prison, both on a per capita basis and in absolute numbers, than any other country on earth. And we're supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave? I don't think so.
Exactly.
And it's all because we privatized our prisons. There's this thing called the commons that should never be privatized. It's just, you know, if we privatized our fire departments, and you could make a buck putting out fires, I'll bet you would start suddenly seeing an increase in arson. It's like as long as somebody can make a buck off it, they're going to figure out a way to make $2 off it. And the commons is something that nobody should be making a buck off of. It should be run for the public good. Right. That includes our jails. So was that's what you wanted me to speak to, or you wanted to speak to, or we spoke to?
Yeah, that's, you know.
Okay, great. Paul, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 950 there in Minneapolis. It's a great station. Joe in Ashburnham, Massachusetts. Hey, Joe.
Ashburnham.
Okay, great.
10 days ago, either on Free Speech or a link, I heard a statement. Hundreds of millions of people worldwide will voluntarily shut their power off Saturday night. This was last Saturday, from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m., your own time zone.
Mm-hmm.
This should have caused quite a downward power wave across the world if it caught on.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. I don't know if you heard about this.
I did not, actually. And there's a lot of those kind of things that happen that I just miss. I mean, it may well be that this was a big deal, and I somehow missed it. Shano, you don't know about it either. I mean, we keep a pretty close ear to the ground with regard to news and events. So this, you know, it sounds like a great idea. I wish it had gotten more publicity. We certainly would have put somebody on the air about it.
My wife said she heard the same thing a year ago.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great idea. And Joe, I'll have to look for it. So thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the info. Danette, we have just 1 minute to the end of the show. It's yours. You want to talk about Scalia?
Yes, I do want to talk about Scalia. I am really sad that he is on the bench for life. He's a racist, and he doesn't need to be on the bench. For him to say that the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is racial entitlement,
mm-hmm.
if he wants to phrase it that way, he's darn straight. Black people, this country was built on the back of black people.
Yep.
And black people are entitled to the right to vote.
Yep.
And I am absolutely disgusted that he would say something like that. I am just, there's so many things going on in this country right now, and I'm that armchair political quarterback. I yell at the TV. Mm-hmm. My kids listen to Sirius XM all day long, and they can mimic the voices of the different radio shows that I listen to. And I'm at a point right now where I am going to step out of my comfort zone and do that petition, and I'm going to start being active.
Good on you. Good on you, Danette. Danette, we're out of time, but thank you for the call. And I agree with you about Scalia. I think he should just stop wearing the black robes and wear his white hood. You know, it's show up in his real costume. Thank you for the call. Coming up Monday, we'll have all the latest news and information from the weekend. Has the sequester had an impact on you yet? We'll talk with Elliot Richardson, president of the Illinois Small Business Advocacy Council, about the effects he's seen. And the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you go to pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org or free-don.org. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.